existing state of things, all these tables and details will not serve to convince those of the middle classes, nor alas those of the workers tainted with middle class prejudices, who regard the people as a mob of savages, ready to fall upon and devour each other as soon as the government ceases to direct affairs. But those only who have never seen the people resolve and act on their own initiative could doubt for a moment that if the masses were masters of the situation, they would distribute rations to each and all in strictest accordance with justice and equity. If you were to give utterance in any gathering of people to the opinion that delicacies, game and such like, should be reserved for the fastidious palates of aristocratic idlers and black bread given to the sick in the hospitals, you would be hissed. But at the same gathering, preach at the street corners and in the marketplaces that the most tempting delicacies ought to be kept for the sick and feeble, especially for the sick. Say that if there are only 5 brace of partridge in the entire city and only 1 case of sherry, they should go to sick people and convalescents. Say that after the sick come the children, for them the milk of the cows and goats should be reserved if there is not enough for all, to the children and the aged the last piece of meat, and to the strong man dry bread, if the community be reduced to that extremity. Say in a word, that if this or that article of consumption runs short and has to be doled out to those who have most need, most should be given. Say that and see if you do not meet with universal agreement. The man who is full fed does not understand this, but the people do understand and have always understood it. And even the child of luxury, if he is thrown on the street and comes into contact with the masses, even he will learn to understand. The theorists for whom the soldier's uniform and the barrack mess table are civilization's last word would like no doubt to start a regime of national kitchens and Spartan broth. They would point out the advantages thereby gained, the economy in fuel and food, if such huge kitchens were established, where everyone could come for their rations of soup and bread and vegetables. We do not question these advantages. We are well aware that important economies have already been achieved in this direction, as for instance, when the handmill or quern and the baker's oven attached to each house were abandoned. We can see perfectly well that it would be more economical to cook broth for 100 families at once, instead of lighting 100 separate fires. We know besides that there are 1,000 ways of preparing potatoes, but that cooked in one huge pot for 100 families, they would be just as good. We know in fact that variety in cooking, being a matter of the seasoning introduced by each cook or housewife, the cooking together of 100 weight of potatoes would not prevent each cook or housewife from dressing and serving them in any way she pleased. And we know that stock made from meat can be converted into 100 different soups to suit 100 different tastes. But though we are quite aware of all these facts, we still maintain that no one has a right to force a housewife to take her potatoes from the communal kitchen ready cooked if she prefers to cook them herself in her own pot on her own fire. And above all, we should wish each one to be free to take his meals with his family or with his friends, or even in a restaurant if it seemed good to him. Naturally, large public kitchens will spring up to take the place of the restaurants where people are poisoned nowadays. Already the Parisian housewife gets the stock for her soup from the butcher and transform it into whatever soup she likes, and London housekeepers know that they can have a joint roasted, or an apple, or rhubarb tart, baked at the baker's for a trifling sum, thus economizing time and fuel. And when the communal kitchen, the common bakehouse of the future, is established, and people can get their food cooked without the risk of being cheated or poisoned, the custom will no doubt become general of going to the communal kitchen for the fundamental parts of a meal, leaving the last touches to be added as individual taste shall suggest. But to make a hard and fast rule of this, to make a duty of taking home our food ready cooked, that would be as repugnant to our body and minds as the ideas of a convent or a barrack, morbid ideas born in brains warped by tyranny or superstition. Who will have a right to the food of the commune will assuredly be the first question which we shall have to ask ourselves. Every township will answer for itself, and we are convinced that the answers will all be dictated by the sentiment of justice. Until labor is reorganized, as long as the disturbed period lasts, and while it is impossible to distinguish between inveterate idlers and genuine workers thrown out of work, the available food ought to be shared by all without exception. Those who have been enemies to the new order will hasten of their own accord to rid the commune of their presence, But it seems to us that the masses of the people, which have always been magnanimous and have nothing of vindictiveness in their disposition, will be ready to share their bread with all who remain with them, conquered and conquerors alike. It will be no loss to the revolution to be inspired by such an idea. And when work is set agoing again, the antagonists of yesterday will stand side by side in the same workshops. A society where work is free will have nothing to fear from idlers. But provisions will run short in a month, our critics at once explain. So much better, say we. It will prove that for the first time on record, the people have had enough to eat. As to the question of obtaining fresh supplies, we shall discuss the means in our next chapter. Part 5. By what means could a city in a state of revolution be supplied with food? We shall answer this question, but it is obvious that the means resorted to will depend on the character of the revolution in the provinces and in neighboring countries. If the entire nation, or better still, if all Europe should accomplish the social revolution simultaneously and start with thoroughgoing communism, our procedure would be simplified. But if only a few communities in Europe make the attempt, other means will have to be chosen. The circumstances will dictate the measures. We are thus led, before we proceed further, to glance at the state of Europe, and without pretending to prophesy, we may try to foresee what course the revolution will take, or at least what will be its essential features. Certainly, it would be very desirable that all Europe should rise at once, that expropriation should be general, and that communistic principles should inspire all and sundry. Such a universal rising would do much to simplify the task of our century. But all the signs lead us to believe that it will not take place. That the revolution will embrace Europe, we do not doubt. If one of the four great continental capitals, Paris, Vienna, Brussels, or Berlin, rises in revolution and overturns its government, it is almost certain that the three others will follow its example within a few weeks' time. It is moreover highly probable that the peninsulas and even London and St. Petersburg would not be long in following suit. But whether the revolution would everywhere exhibit the same characteristics is highly doubtful. It is more than probable that expropriation will be everywhere carried into effect on a larger scale, and that this policy carried out by any one of the great nations of Europe will influence all the rest. Yet the beginnings of a revolution will exhibit great local differences, and its course will vary in different countries. In 1789-93, the French peasantry took 4 years to finally rid themselves of the redemption of feudal rights, and the bourgeois to overthrow royalty. Let us keep that in mind, and therefore be prepared to see the revolution develop itself somewhat gradually. Let us not be disheartened if here and there its steps should move less rapidly. Whether it would take an avowedly socialist character in all European nations, at any rate at the beginning, is doubtful. Germany, be it remembered, is still realizing its dream of a united empire. Its advent parties see visions of a Jacobin Republic like that of 1848, and of the organization of labor according to Louis Blanc, while the French people, on the other hand, want above all things a free commune. Whether it be a communist commune or not, there is every reason to believe that when the coming revolution takes place, Germany will go further than France went in 1793. The 18th century revolution in France was an advance on the English revolution of the 17th, abolishing, as it did at one stroke, the power of the throne and the landed aristocracy, whose influence still survives in England. But if Germany goes further and does greater things than France did in 1793, there can be no doubt that the ideas which will foster the birth of her revolution will be those of 1848, while the ideas which will inspire the revolution in Russia will probably be a combination of those of 1789 with those of 1848. Without, however, attaching to these forecasts a greater importance than they merit, we may safely conclude this much. The revolution will take a different character in each of the different European nations. The point attained in the socialization of wealth will not be everywhere the same. Will it therefore be necessary, as is sometimes suggested, that the nations in the vanguard of the movement should adapt their pace to those who lag behind? Must we wait till the communist revolution is ripe in all civilized countries? Clearly not. Even if it were a thing to be desired, it is not possible. History does not wait for the laggards. Besides, we do not believe that in any one country the revolution will be accomplished at a stroke, in the twinkling of an eye, as some socialists dream. Footnote: no fallacy more harmful has ever been spread than the fallacy of a one-day revolution, which is propagated in superficial socialist pamphlets speaking of a revolution of the 18th of March at Berlin. Suppose (which is absolutely wrong) to have given Prussia its representative government. We saw well the harm made by such fallacies in Russia in 1905 to 1907. The truth is that up to 1871, Prussia, like Russia of the present day, had a scrap of paper which could be described as a constitution, but it had no representative government. The ministry imposed upon the nation, up till 1870, the budget it chose to propose. Footnote. It is highly probable that if one of the five or six large towns of France, Paris, Lyon, Marseille, Lille, Saint-Étienne, Bordeaux, were to proclaim the commune, the others would follow its example, and that many smaller towns would do the same. Probably also various mining districts and industrial centers would hasten to rid themselves of owners and masters and form themselves into free groups. But many country places have not advanced to that point. Side by side with the revolutionary communes, such places would remain in an expectant attitude and would go on living on the individualist system. Undisturbed by visits of the bailiff or the tax collector, the peasants would not be hostile to the revolutionaries, and thus, while profiting by the new state of affairs, they would defer the settlement of accounts with the local exploiters. But with that practical enthusiasm which always characterizes agrarian uprisings, witness the passionate toil of 1792, they would throw themselves into the task of cultivating the land, which, freed from taxes and mortgages, would become so much dearer to them. As to other countries, revolution would break out everywhere. But revolution under diverse aspects, in one country state socialism, in another federation, everywhere more or less socialism, not conforming to any particular rule. Part 6. Let us now return to our city in revolt, and consider how its citizens can provide foodstuffs for themselves. How are the necessary provisions to be obtained if the nation as a whole has not accepted communism? This is the question to be solved. Take, for example, one of the large French towns. Take the capital itself, for that matter. Paris consumes every year thousands of tons of grain, 400,000 head of oxen, 300,000 calves, 400,000 swine, and more than 2 millions of sheep, besides great quantities of game. This huge city devours, besides, more than 20 million pounds of butter, 200 million eggs, and other produce in like proportion. It imports flour and grain from the United States and from Russia, Hungary, Italy, Egypt, and the Indies, livestock from Germany, Italy, Spain, even Romania and Russia. And as for groceries, there is not a country in the world that it does not lay under contribution. Now let us see how Paris or any other great town could be revictualled by homegrown produce, supplies of which could be readily and willingly sent in from the provinces. To those who put their trust in authority, the question will appear quite simple. They would begin by establishing a strongly centralized government, furnished with all the machinery of coercion, the police, the army, the guillotine. This government would draw up a statement of all the produce contained in France. It would divide the country into districts of supply, and then command that a prescribed quantity of some particular foodstuff be sent to such a place on such a day, and delivered at such a station, to be there received on a given day by a specified official and stored in particular warehouses. Now we declare with the fullest conviction not merely that such a solution is undesirable, but that it never could by any possibility be put into practice. It is wildly utopian. Pen in hand, one may dream such a dream in the study, but in contact with reality it comes to nothing. This was proved in 1793, for like all such theories, it leaves out of account the spirit of independence that is in man. The attempt would lead to a universal uprising, to three or four Vendées, to the villages rising against the towns, all the country up in arms defying the city for its arrogance in attempting to impose such a system upon the country. We have already had too much of Jacobin utopias. Let us see if some other form of organization will meet the case. During the great French Revolution, the provinces stormed the large towns and killed the revolution. And yet it is a known fact that the production of grain in France during 1792-3 had not diminished. Indeed, the evidence goes to show that it had increased. But after having taken possession of the manorial lands, after having reaped a harvest from them, the peasants would not part with their grain for paper money. They withheld their produce, waiting for a rise in the price or the introduction of gold. The most rigorous measures of the National Convention were without avail, and her execution failed to break up the ring or force the farmers to sell their corn. For it is a matter of history that the commissaries of the Convention did not scruple to guillotine those who withheld their grain from the market and pitilessly executed those who speculated in foodstuffs. All the same, the corn was not forthcoming, and the townsfolk suffered from famine. But what was offered to the husbandman in exchange for his hard toil? Assignats, scraps of paper decreasing in value every day, promises of payment which could not be kept. A 40-pound note would not purchase a pair of boots, and the peasant, very naturally, was not anxious to barter a year's toil for a piece of paper with which he could not even buy a shirt. As long as worthless paper money, whether called assignats or labor notes, is offered to the peasant producer, it will always be the same. The country will withhold its produce, and the towns will suffer want, even if the recalcitrant peasants are guillotined as before. We must offer to the peasant in exchange for his toil, not worthless paper money, but the manufactured articles of which he stands in immediate need. He lacks the proper implements to till the land, clothes to protect him from the inclemencies of the weather, lamps and oil to replace his miserable rushlight or tallow dip, spades, rakes, plough. All these things, under present conditions, the peasant is forced to do without, not because he does not feel the need of them, but because in his life of struggle and privation, 1,000 useful things are beyond his reach, because he has not money to buy them. Let the town apply itself, without loss of time, to manufacturing all that the peasant needs, instead of fashioning gigots for the wives of rich citizens. Let the sewing machines of Paris be set to work on clovers for the country folk, workaday clovers, and clovers for Sunday too, instead of costly evening dresses for the English and Russian landlords and the African gold magnates' wives. Let the factories and foundries turn out agricultural implements, spades, rakes, and such like, instead of waiting till the English send them to France in exchange for French wines. Let the town send no more inspectors to the villages wearing red, blue, or rainbow-colored scarves to convey to the peasant orders to take his produce to this place or that, but let them send friendly embassies to the country folk and bid them in brotherly fashion, "Bring us your produce and take from our stores and shops all the manufactured articles you please." Then provisions would pour in on every side. The peasant would only withhold what he needed for his own use, and would send the rest into the cities, feeling for the first time in the course of history that these toiling townsfolk were his comrades, his brethren, and not his exploiters. We shall be told, perhaps, that this would necessitate a complete transformation of industry. Well, yes, that is true of certain departments, but there are other branches which could be rapidly modified in such a way as to furnish the peasant with clothes, watches, furniture, and the simple implements for which the towns make him pay such exorbitant prices at the present time. Weavers, tailors, shoemakers, tinsmiths, cabinet makers, and many other trades and crafts could easily direct their energies to the manufacture of useful and necessary articles, and abstain from producing mere luxuries. All that is needed is that the public mind should be thoroughly convinced of the necessity of this transformation, and should come to look upon it as an act of justice and of progress, and that it should no longer allow itself to be cheated by that dream, so dear to the theorists, the dream of a revolution which confines itself to taking possession of the profits of industry, and leaves production and commerce just as they are now. This, then, is our view of the whole question. Cheat the peasant no longer with scraps of paper, be the sums inscribed upon them ever so large, but offer him in exchange for his produce the very things of which he, the tiller of the soil, stands in need. Then the fruits of the land will be poured into the towns. If this is not done, there will be famine in our cities, and reaction and despair will follow in its train. Part 7. All the great towns, we have said, buy their grain, their flour, and their meat, not only from the provinces, but also from abroad. Foreign countries send Paris not only spices, fish, and various dainties, but also immense quantities of corn and meat. But when the revolution comes, these cities will have to depend on foreign countries as little as possible. If Russian wheat, Italian or Indian rice, and Spanish or Hungarian wines abound in the markets of Western Europe, it is not the countries which export them have a superabundance, or that such a produce grows there of itself, like the dandelion in the meadows. In Russia, for instance, the peasant works 16 hours a day, and half starves from 3 to 6 months every year, in order to export the grain with which he pays the landlord and the state. Today, the police appears in the Russian village as soon as the harvest is gathered in, and says the peasants lost horse and lost cow for arrears of taxes and rent due to the landlord, unless the victim immolates himself of his own accord by selling the grain to the exporters. Usually, rather than part with his livestock at a disadvantage, he keeps only a 9 months supply of grain and sells the rest. Then, in order to sustain life until the next harvest, he mixes birch bark and tears with his flour for 3 months if it has been a good year, and for 6 months if it has been bad, while in London they are eating biscuits made of his weight. But as soon as the revolution comes, the Russian peasant will keep bread enough for himself and his children. The Italian and Hungarian peasants will do the same. The Hindu, let us hope, will profit by these good examples, and the farmers of America will hardly be able to cover all the deficit in grain which Europe will experience. So it will not do to count on their contributions of wheat and maize satisfying all the wants. Since all our middle-class civilization is based on the exploitation of inferior races and countries with less advanced industrial systems, the revolution will confer a boon at the very outset, by menacing that civilization and allowing the so-called inferior races to free themselves. But this great benefit will manifest itself by a steady and marked diminution of the food supplies pouring into the great cities of Western Europe. It is difficult to predict the course of affairs in the provinces. On the one hand, the slave of the soil will take advantage of the revolution to straighten his bowed back. Instead of working 14 or 15 hours a day, as he does at present, he will be at liberty to work only half that time, which of course would have the effect of decreasing the production of the principal articles of consumption, grain and meat. But on the other hand, there will be an increase of production as soon as the peasant realizes that he is no longer forced to support the idle rich by his toil. New tracts of land will be cleared, new and improved machines set going. Never was the land so energetically cultivated as in 1792, when the peasant had taken back from the landlord the soil which he had coveted so long. Michelet tells us, speaking of a great revolution, "Of course, before long, intensive culture would be within the reach of all. Improved machinery, chemical manures, and all such matters would soon be supplied by the commune. But everything tends to indicate that at the outset there would be a falling off in agricultural products in France and elsewhere. In any case, it would be wisest to count upon such a falling off of contributions from the provinces as well as from abroad. How is this falling off to be made good? Why? By setting to work ourselves. No need to rack our brains for far-fetched panaceas when the remedy lies close at hand. The large towns, as well as the villages, must undertake to till the soil. We must return to what biology calls the integration of functions. After the division of labor, the taking up of it as a whole, this is the course followed throughout nature. Besides philosophy apart, the force of circumstances would bring about this result. Let Paris see that at the end of 8 months it will be running short of bread, and Paris will set to work to grow wheat. Land will not be wanting, for it is round the great towns, and round Paris especially, that the parks and pleasure grounds of the landed gentry ought to be found. These thousands of acres only await the skilled labor of the husbandman to surround Paris with fields infinitely more fertile and productive than the steppes of southern Russia, where the soil is dried up by the sun. Nor will labor be lacking. To what should the 2 million citizens of Paris turn their attention, when they would be no longer catering for the luxurious fads and amusements of Russian princes, Romanian grandees, and wives of Berlin financiers? With all the mechanical inventions of the century, with all the intelligence and technical skill of a worker accustomed to deal with complicated machinery, with inventors, chemists, professors of botany, practical botanists like the market gardeners of Gennevilliers, with all the plants that they could use for multiplying and improving machinery, and finally with the organizing spirit of the Parisian people, their pluck and energy, with all these at its command, the agriculture of the anarchist commune of Paris would be a very different thing from the rude husbandry of the Hardens. Steam, electricity, the heat of the sun, and the breath of the wind will ere long be pressed into service. The steam plough and the steam harrow will quickly do the rough work of preparation, and the soil, thus clean and enriched, will only need the intelligent care of men and of women, even more than men, to be clothed with luxuriant vegetation not once but 3 or 4 times in the year. Thus learning the art of horticulture from experts, and trying experiments in different methods on small patches of soil reserved for the purpose of vying with each other to obtain the best returns, finding in physical exercise, without exertion or overwork, the health and strength which so often flags in cities, men, women and children will gladly turn to the labor of the fields when it is no longer a slavish drudgery, but has become a pleasure, a festival, a renewal of health and joy. There are no barren lands. The earth is worth what man is worth. That is the last word of modern agriculture. Ask of the earth and she will give you bread, provided that you ask aright. A district, though it were as small as the 2 departments of the Seine and the Seine was, and with so great a city as Paris to feed, would be practically sufficient to grow upon it all the food supplies which otherwise might fail to reach it. The combination of agriculture and industry, the husbandman and the mechanic in the same individual, this is what anarchist communism will inevitably lead us to, if it starts fair with expropriation. Let the revolution only get so far, and famine is not the enemy it will have to fear. No, the danger which will menace it lies in timidity, prejudice and half measures. The danger is where Danton saw it when he cried to France, de l'audace et encore de l'audace. The bold fought first, and the bold deed will not fail to follow. Chapter 6. Dwellings. Part 1. Those who have closely watched the growth of socialist ideas among the workers must have noticed that on one momentous question, the housing of the people, a definite conclusion is being imperceptibly arrived at. It is a fact that in the large towns of France, and in many of the smaller ones, the workers are coming gradually to the conclusion that dwelling houses are in no sense the property of those whom the state recognizes as their owners. This idea has evolved naturally in the minds of the people, and nothing will ever convince them again that the rights of property ought to extend to houses. The house was not built by its owner. It was erected, decorated, and furnished by innumerable workers in the timber yard, the brick field, and the workshop, toiling for dear life at a minimum wage. The money spent by the owner was not the product of his own toil. It was amassed, like all other riches, by paying the workers two-thirds or only a half of what was their due. Moreover, and it is here that the enormity of the whole proceeding becomes more glaring, the house owes its actual value to the profit which the owner can make out of it. Now this profit results from the fact that his house is built in a town, that is, in an agglomeration of thousands of other houses, possessing paved streets, bridges, quays, and fine public buildings, well lighted and affording to its inhabitants a thousand comforts and conveniences unknown in villages, a town in regular communication with other towns, and itself a center of industry, commerce, science, and art, a town which the work of 20 or 30 generations has made habitable, healthy, and beautiful. A house in certain parts of Paris is valued at many thousands of pounds sterling, not because thousands of pounds worth of labor have been expended on that particular house, but because it is in Paris, because for centuries workmen, artists, thinkers, and men of learning and letters have contributed to make Paris what it is today, a center of industry, commerce, politics, art, and science. Because Paris has a past, because thanks to literature, the names of its streets are household words in foreign countries as well as at home. Because it is the fruit of 18 centuries of toil, the work of 50 generations of the whole French nation. Who then can appropriate to himself the tiniest plot of ground or the meanest building in such a city without committing a flagrant injustice? Who then has the right to sell to any bidder the smallest portion of the common heritage? On that point, as we have said, the workers begin to be agreed. The idea of free dwellings showed its existence very plainly during the siege of Paris, when the cry was for an abatement pure and simple of the terms demanded by the landlords. It appeared again during the Commune of 1871, when the Paris workmen expected the Council of the Commune to decide boldly on the abolition of rent. And when the new revolution comes, it will be the first question with which the poor will concern themselves. Whether in time of revolution or in time of peace, the worker must be housed somehow or other. He must have some sort of roof over his head. But however tumble down and squalid his dwelling may be, there is always a landlord who can evict him. True, during the revolution, the landlord cannot fine bailiffs and police sergeants to throw the workmen's rags and chattels into the street. But who knows what the new government will do tomorrow? Who can say that it will not call coercion to its aid again, and set the police pack upon the tenant to hound him out of his hovels? Have we not seen the Commune of Paris proclaim the remission of rents due up to the 1st of April only? The decree of the 30 March, by this decree, rents due up to the terms of October 1870 and January and April 1871 were annulled. After that, rent had to be paid, though Paris was in a state of chaos and industry at a standstill, so that the federate who had taken arms to defend the independence of Paris had absolutely nothing to depend upon, he and his family, but an allowance of 15 pence a day. Now the worker must be made to see clearly that in refusing to pay rent to a landowner or owner, he is not simply profiting by the disorganization of authority. He must understand that the abolition of rent is a recognized principle, sanctioned, so to speak, by popular assent, that to be housed rent-free is a right proclaimed aloud by the people. Are we going to wait till this measure, which is in harmony with every honest man's sense of justice, is taken up by the few socialists scattered among the middle-class elements, of which the provisionary government will be composed. If it were so, the people should have to wait long, till the return of reaction in fact. This is why, refusing uniforms and badges, those outward signs of authority and servitude, and remaining people among the people, the earnest revolutionists will work side by side with the masses, that the abolition of rent, the expropriation of houses, may become an accomplished fact. They will prepare the ground and encourage ideas to grow in this direction. And when the fruit of their labors is ripe, the people will proceed to expropriate the houses without giving heed to the theories which will certainly be thrust in their way, theories about paying compensation to landlords and finding first the necessary funds. On the day that the expropriation of houses takes place, on that day, the exploited workers will have realized that new times have come, that labor will no longer have to bear the yoke of the rich and powerful, that equality has been openly proclaimed, that this revolution is a real fact and not a theatrical make-believe like so many others preceding it. Part 2. If the idea of expropriation be adopted by the people, it will be carried into effect in spite of all the insurmountable obstacles with which we are menaced. Of course, the good folk in new uniforms, seated in the official armchairs of the Hôtel de Ville, will be sure to busy themselves in heaping up obstacles. They will talk of giving compensation to the landlords, of preparing statistics and drawing up long reports. Yes, they would be capable of drawing up reports long enough to outlast the hopes of the people, who, after waiting and starving in enforced idleness and seeing nothing come of all these official researchers, would lose heart and faith in the revolution and abandon the field to the reactionaries. The new bureaucracy would end by making expropriation hateful in the eyes of all. Here indeed is a rock which might shipwreck our hopes. But if the people turn a deaf ear to the specious arguments used to dazzle them, and realize that new life needs new conditions, and if they undertake the task themselves, then expropriation can be effected without any great difficulty. But how? How can it be done? You ask us. We shall try to reply to this question, but with a reservation. We have no intention of tracing out the plans of expropriation in their smallest details. We know beforehand that all that any man or group of men could suggest today would be far surpassed by the reality when it comes. Men will accomplish greater things and accomplish them better and by simpler methods than those dictated to him beforehand. Thus we shall merely indicate the manner by which expropriation might be accomplished without the intervention of government. We do not propose to go out of our way to answer those who declare that the thing is impossible. We confine ourselves to replying that we are not the upholders of any particular method of organization. We are only concerned to demonstrate that expropriation could be effected by popular initiative and could not be effected by any other means whatever. It seems very likely that as soon as expropriation is fairly started, groups of volunteers will spring up in every district, street and block of houses and undertake to inquire into the number of flats and houses which are empty and of those which are overcrowded, the unwholesome slums and the houses which are too spacious for their occupants and might well be used to house those who are stifled in swarming tenements. In a few days, these volunteers would have drawn up complete lists for the street and the district of all the flats, tenements, family mansions and villa residences, all the rooms and suite of rooms, healthy and unhealthy, small and large, fitted dens and homes of luxury. Really communicating with each other, these volunteers would soon have their statistics complete. All statistics can be manufactured in boardrooms and offices, but true and exact statistics must begin with the individual and mount up from the simple to the complex. Then, without waiting for anyone's leave, those citizens will probably go and find their comrades who were living in miserable garrets and hovels and will say to them simply, "It is a real revolution this time, comrades, and no mistake about it. Come to such a place this evening, all the neighborhood will be there. We are going to redistribute the dwelling houses. If you are tired of your slum garret, come and choose one of the flats of 5 rooms that are to be disposed of, and when you have once moved in, you shall stay. Never fear. The people are up in arms, and he who would venture to evict you will have to answer to them. But everyone will want a fine house or a spacious flat, we are told. No, you are quite mistaken. It is not the people's way to clamour for the moon. On the contrary, every time we have seen them set about repairing a wrong, he have been struck by the good sense and instinct for justice which animates the masses? Have we ever known them demand the impossible? Have we ever seen the people of Paris fighting among themselves while waiting for their rations of bread or firewood during the two sieges or during the terrible years of 1792 to 1794? The patience and resignation which prevailed among them in 1871 was constantly presented for admiration by the foreign press correspondents. And yet these patient waiters knew full well that the last comers would have to pass the day without food or fire. We do not deny that there are plenty of egotistic instincts in isolated individuals. We are quite aware of it. But we contend that the very way to revive and nourish these instincts would be to confine such questions as the housing of the people to any border committee, in fact to the tender mercies of officialism in any shape or form. Then indeed all the evil passions spring up, and it becomes a case of who is the most influential person on the board. The least inequality causes wranglings and recriminations. If the smallest advantage is given to anyone, a tremendous hue and cry is raised, and not without reason. But if the people themselves, organized by streets, districts and parishes, undertake to move the inhabitants of the slums into the half-empty dwellings of the middle classes, the trifling inconveniences, the little inequalities, will be easily tided over. Rarely has appeal been made to the good instincts of the masses, only as a last resort, to save the sinking ship in times of revolution. But never has such an appeal been made in vain. The heroism, the self-devotion of the toiler, has never failed to respond to it. And thus it will be in the coming revolution. But when all is said and done, some inequalities, some inevitable injustices, undoubtedly will remain. There are individuals in our societies whom no great crisis can lift out of the deep mire of egoism in which they are sunk. The question, however, is not whether there will be injustices or no, but rather how to limit the number of them. Now all history, all the experience of the human race, and all social psychology unite in showing that the best and fairest way is to trust the decision to those whom it concerns most nearly. It is they alone who can consider and allow for the 101 details which must necessarily be overlooked in any merely official redistribution. Part 3. Moreover, it is by no means necessary to make straight away an absolutely equal redistribution of all the dwellings. There will no doubt be some inconveniences at first, but matters will soon be righted in a society which has adopted expropriation. When the masons and carpenters and all who are concerned in house building know that their daily bread is secured to them, they will ask nothing better than to work at their old trades a few hours a day. They will adapt the fine houses, which absorb the time of a whole staff of servants, for giving shelter to several families, and in a few months homes will have sprung up, infinitely healthier and more conveniently arranged than those of today. And to those who are not yet comfortably housed, the anarchist commune will be able to say, "Patience, comrades, palaces fairer and finer than any the capitalists build for themselves will spring from the ground of our enfranchised city. They will belong to those who have most need of them." The anarchist commune does not build with an eye to revenues. These monuments erected to its citizens, products of the collective spirit, will serve as models to all humanity. They will be yours. If the people of the revolution expropriate the houses and proclaim free lodgings, the communalizing of houses and the right of each family to a decent dwelling, then the revolution will have assumed a communistic character from the first, and started on a course from which it will be by no means easy to turn it. It will have struck a fatal blow at individual property. For the expropriation of dwellings contains in germ the whole social revolution. On the manner of its accomplishment depends the character of all that follows. Either we shall start on a good road leading straight to anarchist communism, or we shall remain sticking in the mud of despotic individualism. It is easy to see the numerous objections, theoretic on the one hand, practical on the other, with which we are sure to be met. As it will be a question of maintaining iniquity at any price, our opponents will of course protest in the name of justice. Is it not a crying shame, they will exclaim, that the people of Paris should take possession of all these fine houses, while the peasants in the country have only tumble-down huts to live in? But do not let us make a mistake. These enthusiasts for justice forget, by a lapse of memory to which they are subject, the crying shame which they themselves are tacitly defending. They forget that in this same city the worker, with his wife and children, suffocates in a noisome garret. while from his window he sees the rich man's palace. They forget that whole generations perish in crowded slums, starving for air and sunlight, and that to redress this injustice ought to be the first task of the revolution. Do not let this disingenuous protest hold us back. We know that any inequality which may exist between town and country in the early days of a revolution will be transitory and of a nature that will right itself from day to day. For the village will not fail to improve its dwellings as soon as the peasant has ceased to be the beast of burden of the farmer, the merchant, the money lender, and the state. In order to avoid an accidental and transitory inequality, shall we stay our hand from righting an ancient wrong? The so-called practical objections are not very formidable either. We are bidden to consider the hard case of some poor fellow who by dint of privation has contrived to buy a house just large enough to hold his family, and we are going to deprive him of his hard-earned happiness, to turn him into the street. Certainly not. If his house is only just large enough for his family, by all means let him stay there. Let him work in his little garden too. Our boys will not hinder him. Nay, they will lend him a helping hand if need be. But suppose he lets lodgings, suppose he has empty rooms in his house, then the people will make the lodger understand that he need not pay his former landlord any more rent. Stay where you are, but rent free. No more dens and collectors. Socialism has abolished all that. Or again, suppose that the landlord has a score of rooms all to himself, and some poor woman lives nearby with 5 children in one room. In that case, the people would see whether, with some alterations, these empty rooms could not be converted into a suitable home for the poor woman and her 5 children. Would not that be more just and fair than to leave the mother and her 5 little ones languishing in a garret while Sir Gorgeous Midas sat at his ease in an empty mansion? Besides, good Sir Gorgeous would probably have stand to do it of his own accord. His wife shall be delighted to be freed from half her big, unwieldy house when there is no longer a staff of servants to keep it in order. So you are going to turn everything upside down, say the defenders of law and order. There will be no end to the evictions and removals. Would it not be better to start fresh by turning everyone out of doors and redistributing the houses by lot? Thus our critics, but we are firmly persuaded that if no government interferes in the matter, if all the changes are entrusted to these free groups which have sprung up to undertake the work, the evictions and removals will be less numerous than those which take place in 1 year under the present system, owing to the rapacity of landlords. In the first place, there are in all large towns almost enough empty houses and flats to lodge all the inhabitants of the slums. As to the palaces and suites of fine apartments, many working people would not live in them if they could. One could not keep up such houses without a large staff of servants. Their occupants would soon find themselves forced to seek less luxurious dwellings. The fine ladies would find that palaces were not well adapted to self-help in the kitchen. Gradually, people would shake down. There would be no need to conduct dives to a garret at the bayonet's point, or install Lazarus in Dives' palace by the help of an armed escort. People would shake down amicably into the available dwellings with the least possible friction and disturbance. Have we not the example of the village communes redistributing fields and disturbing the owners of the allotments so little that one can only praise the intelligence and good sense of the methods they employ? Fewer fields change hands under the management of a Russian commune than where personal property holds sway and is forever carrying its quarrels into courts of law. And are we to believe that the inhabitants of a great European city would be less intelligent and less capable of organization than Russian or Hindu peasants? Moreover, we must not blink at the fact that every revolution means a certain disturbance to everyday life, and those who expect this tremendous climb out of the old grooves to be accomplished without so much as jarring the dishes on their dinner tables will find themselves mistaken. It is true that governments can change without disturbing worthy citizens at dinner, but the crimes of society towards those who have nourished and supported it are not to be redressed by any such political sleight of parties. Undoubtedly there will be a disturbance, but it must not be one of pureness. It must be minimized, and again it is impossible to lay too much stress on this maxim. It will be by addressing ourselves to the interested parties and not to boards and committees. is that we shall best succeed in reducing the sum of inconveniences for everybody. The people commit blunder on blunder when they have to choose by ballot some harebrained candidate who solicits the honor of representing them, and takes upon himself to know all, to do all, and to organize all. But when they take upon themselves to organize what they know, what touches them directly, they do it better than all the talking shop together. Is not the Paris Commune an instance in point, and the great Dockers strike, and have we not constant evidence of this fact in every village commune? Chapter 7. Clothing. When the houses have become the common heritage of the citizens, and when each man has his daily supply of food, another forward step will have to be taken. The question of clothing will of course demand consideration next, and again the only possible solution will be to take possession in the name of the people of all the shops and warehouses where clothing is sold or stored, and to throw open the doors to all, so that each can take what he needs. The communalization of clothing, the right of each to take what he needs from the communal stores, or to have it made for him at the tailors and outfitters, is a necessary corollary of the communalization of houses and food. Obviously, we shall not need for that to despoil all citizens of their goods, to put all the garments in a heap and draw lots for them, as our critics, with equal wit and ingenuity, suggest. Let him who has a coat keep it still. Nay, if he have 10 coats, it is highly improbable that anyone will want to deprive him of them, for most folk will prefer a new coat to one that has already graced the shoulders of some fat bourgeois, and there will be enough new garments and to spare without having recourse to second-hand wardrobes. If we were to take an inventory of all the clothes and stuff for clothing accumulated in the shops and stores of the large towns, we should find probably that in Paris, Lyon, Bordeaux and Marseille, there was enough to enable the commune to offer garments to all the citizens of both sexes, and if all were not suited at once, the communal outfitters would soon make good these shortcomings. We know how rapidly our great tailoring and dressmaking establishments work nowadays, provided as they are with machinery especially adapted for production on a large scale. But everyone will want a sable-lined coat or a velvet gown, exclaim our adversaries. Frankly, we do not believe it. Every woman does not dote on velvet, nor does every man dream of sable linings. Even now, if we were to ask each woman to choose her gown, we should find some to prefer a simple, practical garment to all the fantastic trimmings the fashionable world affects. Taste change with the times, and the fashion in vogue at the time of a revolution will certainly make for simplicity. Societies, like individuals, have their hours of cowardice, but also their heroic moments, and though the society of today cuts a very poor figure, sunk in the pursuit of narrow personal interests and second-rate ideas, it wears a different air when great crises come. It has its moments of greatness and enthusiasm. Men of generous nature will gain the power which today is in the hands of jobbers. Self-devotion will spring up and noble deeds beget their like. Even the egotists will be ashamed of hanging back and will be drawn in spite of themselves to admire, if not to imitate, the generous and brave. The great revolution of 1793 abounds in examples of this kind, and it is always during such times of spiritual revival, as natural to societies as to individuals, that the spring tide of enthusiasm sweeps humanity onwards. We do not wish to exaggerate the part played by such noble passions, nor is it upon them that we would found our ideal of society, but we are not asking too much if we expect their aid in tiding over the first and most difficult moments. We cannot hope that our daily life will be continuously inspired by such exalted enthusiasms, but we may expect their aid at the first, and that is all we need. It is just to wash the earth clean, to sweep away the shorts and refuse accumulated by centuries of slavery and oppression, that the new anarchist society will have need of this wave of brotherly love. Later on, it can exist without appealing to the spirit of self-sacrifice, because it will have eliminated oppression, and thus created a new world instinct with all the feelings of solidarity. Besides, should the character of a revolution be such as we have sketched here, the free initiative of individuals would find an extensive field of action in thwarting the efforts of the egotists. Groups would spring up in every street and quarter to undertake the charge of the clothing. They would make inventories of all that the city possessed, and would find out approximately what were the resources at their disposal. It is more than likely that in the matter of clothing, the citizens would adopt the same principle as in the matter of provisions. That is to say, they would offer freely from the common store everything which was to be found in abundance, and dole out whatever was limited in quantity. Not being able to offer to each man a sable lined coat and to every woman a velvet gown, society would probably distinguish between the superfluous and the necessary, and provisionally at least class sable and velvet among the superfluities of life, ready to let time prove whether what is a luxury today may not become common to all tomorrow. While the necessary clothing would be guaranteed to each inhabitant of the anarchist city, it would be left to private activity to provide for the sick and feeble those things provisionally considered as luxuries, and to procure for the less robust such special articles as would not enter into the daily consumption of ordinary citizens. But it may be urged, this means grey uniformity and the end of everything beautiful in life and art. Certainly not, we reply, and still basing our reasonings on what already exists, we are going to show how an anarchist society could satisfy the most artistic tastes of its citizens without allowing them to amass the fortunes of millionaires. Chapter 8. Ways and Means. Part 1. If a society, a city, or a territory were to guarantee the necessaries of life to its inhabitants, and we shall see how the conception of the necessaries of life can be so extended as to include luxuries, it would be compelled to take possession of what is absolutely needed for production, that is to say, land, machinery, factories, means of transport, etc. Capital in the hands of private owners would be expropriated to be returned to the community. The great harm done by a bourgeois society, as we have already mentioned, is not only that capitalists seize a large share of the profits of each industrial and commercial enterprise, thus enabling themselves to live without working, but that all production has taken a wrong direction, as it is not carried on with a view to securing well-being to all. There is the reason why it must be condemned. It is absolutely impossible that mercantile production should be carried on in the interests of all. To desire it would be to expect the capitalist to go beyond his province and to fulfill duties that he cannot fulfill without ceasing to be what he is, a private manufacturer seeking his own enrichment. Capitalist organization, based on the personal interest of each individual employer of labor, has given to society all that could be expected of it. It has increased the productive force of labor. The capitalist, profiting by the revolution effected in industry by steam, by the sudden development of chemistry and machinery, and by other inventions of our century, has worked in his own interest to increase the yield of human labor, and in a great measure he has succeeded so far. But to attribute other duties to him would be unreasonable. For example, to expect that he should use this superior yield of labor in the interest of society as a whole would be to ask philanthropy and charity of him. And a capitalist enterprise cannot be based on charity. It now remains for society, first, to extend this greater productivity, which is limited to certain industries, and to apply it to a general good. But it is evident that to utilize this high productivity of labor, so as to guarantee well-being to all, society must itself take possession of all means of production. Economists, as is their wont, will not fail to remind us of the comparative well-being of a certain category of young, robust workmen, skilled in certain special branches of industry, which has been obtained under the present system. It is always this minority that is pointed out to us with pride. But even this well-being, which is the exclusive right of a few, is it secure? Tomorrow, maybe, negligence, improvidence, or the greed of their employers will deprive these privileged men of their work, and they will pay for the period of comfort they have enjoyed with months and years of poverty or destitution. How many important industries, the textiles, iron, sugar, etc., without mentioning all sorts of short-lived trades, have we not seen decline or come to a standstill on account of speculations or in consequence of natural displacement of work or from the effects of competition amongst the capitalists themselves? If the chief textile and mechanical industries had to pass through such a crisis as they have passed through in 1886, we hardly need mention the small trades, all of which have their periods of standstill. What too shall we say to the price which is paid for the relative well-being of certain categories of workmen? Unfortunately, it is paid for by the ruin of agriculture, the shameless exploitation of the peasants, the misery of the masses. In comparison with the feeble minority of workers who enjoy a certain comfort, how many millions of human beings live from hand to mouth, without a secure wage, ready to go wherever they are wanted? How many peasants work 14 hours a day for a poor pittance? Capital depopulates the country, exploits the colonies and the countries where industries are but little developed, dooms the immense majority of workmen to remain without technical education, to remain mediocre even in their own trade. This is not merely accidental. It is a necessity of the capitalist system. In order well to remunerate certain classes of workmen, peasants must become the beasts of burden of society. The country must be deserted for the town. Small trades must agglomerate in the foul suburbs of large cities and manufacture a thousand little things for next to nothing, so as to bring the goods of the greater industries within reach of buyers with small salaries. That bad cloth may be sold to ill-paid workers. Garments are made by tailors who are satisfied with a starvation wage. Eastern lands in a backward state are exploited by the West, in order that, under the capitalist system, workers in a few privileged industries may obtain certain limited comforts of life. The evil of the present system is therefore not that the surplus value of production goes to the capitalists, as Rodbertus and Marx said, thus narrowing the socialist conception and the general view of the capitalist system. The surplus value itself is but a consequence of deeper causes. The evil lies in the possibility of a surplus value existing, instead of a simple surplus not consumed by each generation. For that a surplus value should exist means that men, women and children are compelled by hunger to sell their labor for a small part of what this labor produces, and still more so, of what their labor is capable of producing. But this evil will last as long as the instruments of production belong to the few, as long as men are compelled to pay heavy tribute to property holders for the right of cultivating land or putting machinery into action, and the owners of the land and the machines are free to produce what bids fair to bring them in the largest profits, rather than the greatest amount of useful commodities. Well-being can only be temporarily guaranteed to a very few. It is only to be bought by the poverty of a large section of society. It is not sufficient to distribute the profits realized by a trade in equal parts. If at the same time thousands of other workers are exploited, it is a case of producing the greatest amount of goods necessary to the well-being of all, with the least possible waste of human energy. This generalized aim cannot be the aim of a private owner. And this is why society as a whole, if it takes this view of production as its ideal, will be compelled to expropriate all that enhances well-being while producing wealth. It will have to take possession of land, factories, mines, means of communication, etc. And besides, it will have to study what products will promote general well-being, as well as the ways and means of an adequate production. Part 2. How many hours a day will men have to work to produce nourishing food, a comfortable home, and necessary clothing for his family? This question has often preoccupied socialists, and they generally came to the conclusion that 4 or 5 hours a day would suffice. On condition, be it well understood, that all men work. At the end of last century, Benjamin Franklin fixed the limit at 5 hours, and if the need of comfort is greater now, the power of production has augmented too, and far more rapidly. In speaking of agriculture further on, we shall see what the earth can be made to yield to man when he cultivates it in a reasonable way, instead of throwing seed haphazard in a badly ploughed soil, as he mostly does today. In the great farms of Western America, some of which cover 30 square miles, but have a poorer soil than the manured soil of civilized countries, only 10 to 15 English bushels per English acre are obtained, that is to say, half the yield of European farms or of American farms in the eastern states. And nevertheless, thanks to machines which enable 2 men to plough 4 English acres a day, 100 men can produce in a year all that is necessary to deliver the bread of 10,000 people at their homes during a whole year. Thus it would suffice for a man to work under the same conditions for 30 hours, say 6 half days of 5 hours each, to have bread for a whole year, and to work 30 half days to guarantee the same to a family of 5 people. We shall also prove by results obtained nowadays that if we took recourse to intensive agriculture, less than 6 half days' work could procure bread, meat, vegetables, and even luxurious food for a whole family. Again, if we study the cost of workmen's dwelling built in large towns today, we can ascertain that to obtain in a large English city a semi-detached little house, as they are built for workmen for £250, from 1,400 to 1,800 half-days' work of 5 hours would be sufficient. And as a house of that kind lasts 50 years at least, it follows that 28 to 36 half days' work a year would provide well-furnished, healthy quarters with all necessary comfort for a family. Whereas, when hiring the same apartment from an employer, a workman pays from 75 to 100 days' work per year. Mark that these figures represent the maximum of what a house costs in England today, being given the defective organization of our societies. In Belgium, workmen's houses in the city over here have been built at a much smaller cost, so that taking everything into consideration, we are justified in affirming that in a well-organized society, 30 or 40 half-days work a year will suffice to guarantee a perfectly comfortable home. There now remains clothing, the exact value of which is almost impossible to fix, because the profits realized by a swarm of middlemen cannot be estimated. Let us take cloth, for example, and add up all the tribute levied on every yard of it by the landowners, the ship owners, the wool merchants, and all their intermediate agents, then by the railway companies, mill owners, weavers, dealers in ready-made clothes, sellers and commission agents, and we shall get then an idea of what we pay to a whole swarm of capitalists for each article of clothing. That is why it is perfectly impossible to say how many days' work an overcoat that you pay £3 or £4 for in a large London shop represents. What is certain is that with present machinery, it is possible to manufacture an incredible amount of goods both cheaply and quickly. A few examples will suffice. Thus, in the United States, in 751 cotton mills, open bracket for spinning and weaving, close bracket, 175,000 men and women produce 2,033,000,000 yards of cotton goods, besides a great quantity of thread. On the average, more than 12,000 yards of cotton goods alone are obtained by a 300 days' work of 9.5 hours each, say 40 yards of cotton in 10 hours. Admitting that a family needs 200 yards a year at most, this would be equivalent to 50 hours' work, say 10 half days of 5 hours each, and we should have thread besides, that is to say cotton to shoe with and thread to weave cloth with, so as to manufacture woolen stuffs mixed with cotton. As to the results obtained by weaving alone, the official statistics of the United States teach us that in 1870, if workmen work 13 or 14